All right, it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Guido Gehry to speak to the Summer School this morning. Guido has had a career-long track record of innovation in modeling of anatomy, more recently looking at how to analyze diffusion tensor images, with applications across the board in neuroscience to many different diseases. I think he'll talk a little bit today about modeling brain growth in childhood and some of the mathematical approaches involved in that. I do want to say that we're mixing up the topics a little bit. Originally, we thought that we'd have an entire day on modeling the cerebral cortex. Monica Hurdle, who's one of our speakers, planned for today, is in Tallahassee. Her plane was canceled last night. So we're having a little bit of a mix-up of topics. But I think it is very valuable because Guido's going to show us some of the topics used in neuroscience more generally, and there will be concepts that we'll go into in much more detail later in the week. So thanks to Guido for coming, and we welcome you here.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. You have seen I added three words to the title, like challenges, limits, and potential. You will see that I don't talk about surface-based analysis, but you will see that we have really the potential to create surfaces for all of you to be analyzed, especially longitudinal change in surfaces. Okay, I would like to acknowledge also my team. There is Marcel Prastava, Casey Gulland, who is also here today, and Sylvain Coulthard. And you see we stand in front of this brand new building, ski building at the University of Utah. And actually the sponsor of this building was John Warnock. John Warnock is the founder of Adobe Acrobat. So I assume whenever you open a file or write a file, you probably have contributed to our beautiful space. So I mostly talk about the longitudinal change in early development. And as I said, I more focus on challenges and do not provide too many solutions because I assume there are a lot of you here who would like to get access to this data and be very creative to present new methodology. So if you look at the time course, here you see the longitudinal axis from birth to adulthood. We see that there are a lot of changes, especially in the early phases of development that are really obvious in regard to synaptic development, myelination, dendritic and axonal remodeling. But as you see here, there's really a gap when we look at the literature and also at the data that come from neuroimaging. So the first 2 years is really not mapped in depth as we see in adulthood. So there's really something that we can still explore, and also methodology, and I will come to that, has become available to actually map using neuroimaging techniques the early developing brain. And with early developing brain, I do not focus on preterm because we do not yet have infants, preterm infants, as David Van Essen had access to, also via the Children's Hospital in Boston. But we have a large data set of children from neonates birth up to 4 years, and especially we have longitudinal data. We map these children regularly, scan them, and get real longitudinal data. So the challenge is really, or the motivation is to understand the rate and variability of normal development. Actually, that's not so strange. So first, when I used this, I thought that's really not, but I just came back from Switzerland, which is also a high-tech country, and nearly everyone has a cell phone. I think it would not be amazing if they had them out for free, even in kindergarten, to be connected to their parents. But we would like to understand the rate and variability of normal development to detect differences in children at risk. And I think that's somehow the main motivation. We have to do some modeling of normal variability, changes, correlation between features. And the main motivation is really the early diagnosis, early therapy, and then towards a better future for families and the kids. And also important is there's a little bit of change also in NIH funding. So far, a lot of research was focused on hypothesis-driven research, and I heard recently more and more this notion of discovery science, so that you also support projects where you do not know in advance what you detect.
And especially in early development, nearly everything that we measure is somehow new. So you cannot say in advance, or you don't have a clear hypothesis in advance what exactly you look for. You know which type of methodology you apply. But I think this is interesting if you would deal with the early development data that become available. Another notion is this developmental trajectory. And I have used the slide from a rare disease, Krabbe's disease, which is a storage disease, a myelination disorder. So kids, if they are not treated, just after birth, die. And you see two categories, symptomatic, these are the kids that do not survive, and the other ones who are treated. So you see two axes here. This is the age of the child, and this is somehow the developmental age. And just a very simple notion, normal is diagonal. So you just map things that you expect and measure, check your child or score your child and say, yes, my child at 2 years of age shows what we accept at 2 years of age. So this is somehow the notion of normal trajectory. Now in Krabbe's disease, one of the major issues after treatment is the motor development. The motor development does not keep pace with the normal development. And you can clearly see that this trajectory is lower than the diagonal. And if you map it out into individuals, you see individual children, if you map somehow motor abilities, they do not really, they are even not close to the diagonal. But this is more details that you don't need to know because I don't tell you anything about Krabbe's disease. But there is this notion of normal development you see here. And somehow this triangle where you see the diagonal is somehow considered to be normal, and there is a variability or a normal variability. And I think that's more as an example that we need to know more about what do we consider as normal variability before we can map the disease or detect changes and do hypothesis testing. So the outline will be, I will talk a little bit about imaging technology for pediatric imaging, then come more to the analysis of structural MRI, talk a little bit about DTI. This is mostly the work of Casey Goodlett. And then talk about towards longitudinal data analysis. So first of all, the challenge is really how to scan babies. And the major challenge is they are non-sedated. At least in our projects in the US, we cannot sedate healthy children. That would be not considered to be ethical for our research studies. So these children have to be somehow made quiet in the scanner. And the reason, or the way how you do it, you feed them, the mother is there at the scanner, you do breastfeeding or bottle feeding, then they sleep, and then you put them into the scanner. But still, you have some subject operation. That's difficult. So neonates, they sleep, but if you have a 6-month-old, 1-year-old, 2 years old. So everyone who has children knows this is not so easy. How do you motivate your child that you should lie in a scanner for 20 minutes and not move? So there are motion problems, safety issues. There are a lot of solutions to that, and also at UNC we have got much better with time. So we have a special training, so the NPRAs, we know how to do it. The children are fed, they're wrapped into a blanket to feel warm and cozy. There are special seats that are constructed, like car seats for small children, these plastic seats, where you can put the coils actually into this head part. There is high-speed imaging, and I will show a few slides about the parallel acquisition training of children that are 2, 3, and 4 years old, and even new technology for motion correction. So, if you could, yes?
Is it easy to recruit parents?
Actually it was much easier than we thought. So I'm not a psychiatrist. They have a nice leaflet and say, please contribute to our study. I mean, they get a free reading of their MRI. But we are surprised, since 5-6 years, we already have about 700 scans of neonates where mothers freely contribute. They don't get money for that. They only get free parking or something. I think that's important. So if you would pay money, you already have a bias. But it's surprisingly easy because we ask all the pregnant mothers at UNC if they want to contribute, and they can talk to others who have contributed. And it's even amazing how many show up even later for a second scan, a third scan, and that's a good sign. If they would hate it, they would not come back. So it's surprisingly easy. But I guess our people do a good job, so that's probably the best answer. So if you look at the first imaging, and unfortunately the media didn't get the Nobel Prize for that, you see this was really crude, but of course it was really influential. That was his first picture of the abdomen. And I like this one. So I got this slide from somebody who did this slide for Bern, but you see fantastic success, 4:45 a.m., first human image. It was 72, so that was... It was long ago, but not too long ago, so it's amazing. But nowadays, we really have much better technology. You see, this is a standard scanner that you can buy. This is a 3 Tesla Siemens, but there are other scanners as well that are on the same level. You can get amazing quality images of amazing quality, and the most important is not only T1 images. If you look at the T1 images, progress is not that dramatic if you look at the images, but if you look at DTI or even T2 weighted isotropic images, you just see it's like day and night. In 5 minutes you can have beautiful scans which make your analysis much, much easier. That doesn't mean we can now segment all the images that we could not segment before, but it's really much better to deal with new data if you have access to this new data than if you have a retrospective analysis on data that is maybe 10 years old. So we use the 3 Tesla technology for high-speed imaging. So you could scan much longer and get beautiful quality images with better signal-to-noise ratio. But due to these problems of motion and a subject cooperation, we just go to the minimum time. And you see we have about 8 minutes for T1, T2 proton density imaging. DTI takes about 4 minutes. So the sessions that we have for children are no longer than 12 to 15 minutes. And that really has to do with patient comfort and patient cooperation. Training, I mentioned that. If you have older children, about 3-4 years old, we have a MOG scanner, we have one at Duke. These are pictures from the Yale version. You just take an old scanner, which is only the plastic or whatever, you paint it like a playroom, and the children can lie on the bed. They come with their DVD or movie, and then you play them, and there is this feedback. If they move the head, the movie switches off. And if they lie still for another 10 seconds, it switches on again. So it's a very efficient feedback training. They hear the sound of the original scanner. They get used to this environment. And usually it takes only one session in this MOG scanner. And the success rate is much, much higher after such a training. Okay, and this is the data that you get. You see here neonate scans. This is a T1. T2, that we have the 1-year-old and the 2-year-old. This is the same baby. We did not align them, so these are the raw data as they come from the scanner. But this is about the quality that you can expect with these 15 minutes acquisitions. I have listed the success rate, but might be not very important for you here if you do math and development of new algorithms. But you see, we started a study at UNC in 2002, and for neonates have a success rate of about 90%. That means from the total number of attempts, we got 223 here, successful data set. We started a study later, 2006, actually with twins. So that's more difficult because now you have two, and you want to have success on both. So here we now get the success rate of 97%, and this has only to do with the training of the personnel, the time of the day that you scan, the way how you do it. You see follow-ups, the numbers are lower, so these are the children that come back. Here we lose some of them, and also at 2 years, this is most difficult. We have here a success rate of 58% and here 69%. So that means if you do a study design and build in statistics, you really have to consider data loss, missing data. And you lose the data because parents move away, they do not come back, some of them are not cooperative, so the children move in the scanner, they cry and they want to go home. So of course it can't be brutal and try again and again. So there are many, many reasons for this loss. But if you do a study, you really have to take this loss into an account and do scanning on a much larger set of subjects than if you would have the ideal no loss situation. Okay, there is also new technology for motion correction. We lose a lot of data because of head motion in the scanner. And GE has a so-called propeller technology, which, to my knowledge, only works in plane, so along an axis, around an axis. Siemens has a navigator shot technique, at least the one that I know, that has been developed at MGH. You see here a subject that on purpose moved significantly during a 10 minutes acquisition, and they do navigator shots to do kind of, while they reconstruct the image from K-space, take into account the motion and give you corrected images. So as soon as these techniques would be available for all sequences that we use, you really would appreciate to use them, because most of the data loss is due to motion and bad quality images. Okay, then the other technology jump that we have is from parallel acquisition, and you might all know about this technology because it becomes really available on all the new scanners. Instead of one head coil, you have the coils that are mounted on a helmet. This is just a prototype design, and you have amplifiers for each coil. So you produce images in parallel and then use signal processing to put them together. Now this looks a little bit scary, but if you leave it to a manufacturer like Siemens, they look beautiful. I mean, this is the new design. So first I only showed these images, especially to parents, and said you can't do that because really it looks scary and we don't want to put our child into a helmet like that. But we see new technology makes it possible. And the change in image quality is really dramatic. So I got this slide from Bruce Rosen, but you see here a volume coil and a 23-channel Bucky coil. Same scanner, same scan time, and you really see, or should see, or if you get the original slides, you can see that more clearly. This is really a very noisy image compared to that. So here you have like a black and white photograph. Okay, so for children, we have a challenge. These coils are quite expensive, and manufacturers are not so keen to produce coils for children because the market is not that large. So it's also an economical question. So with Larry Wald at MGH, we have a joint project that we built shape models for neonates, 6 months old, 1 year old, 2 years old, statistical models. And we actually create these helmets and they glue the coils on these helmets. So we will have soon a range of coils for different scanners for neonate, 6 months old, 1 year old, 2 years old. Now you see it's also a shape question. How many coils do you need to build to optimally adapt for the variability that you get? So this is, for example, a 95 percentile head with the brain that allows the constructors of this helmet to get the shape and the optimal placement of the coils. The other question, and let's just go through all these components that you need to consider if you do longitudinal imaging, is the calibration. So usually we use this type of Herschel phantoms. There is also one for ADNI, which is a sphere that looks like a Sputnik. But in principle, they are just containers with holes, very precisely manufactured. You know the precise truth. You scan them, and then you measure the differences and geometric distortion. MNI recently came up with this study design, which is amazing. So this phantom costs us $3,000. And you can imagine, if you just forget about the word that they have, probably the Duplos, I don't know, cost them $50, and then a bucket, which is manufactured. But this is the design that is used at Montreal Neurological Institute. And we actually got a version of this phantom and use it for a multi-site study. It has advantages because it comes also with a full software package that allows us to recalibrate the data and do the undistortion of the data. Okay, and it's really necessary. I just show you that this is not just a game. We have data from BIAC, which is the Brain Imaging Analysis Center at Duke, which is part of the BERN project. Here we have analyzed data from 2004 to 2006. This was work by James McFall. And we just map the X, Y, Z. X axis is blue, Y, Z axis. This is the voxel size error over time. And you see it can be quite considerable. So 2%, even a spike up to 3, then it goes down to 2. So if you measure volumes over time, if you do very precise analysis, 2% is a lot. So this is actually close to the effect size that you want to find. So it's still necessary to do a very careful calibration. And the reason is that the scanner is not built for precise truth. An MRI scanner is an imaging device. And until a few years ago, probably, we just looked at the data on a screen or as a film. And what we do with the scanner probably is like a misuse of the original technology. Now calibration becomes available, and now we get the data that we need. I skipped this data, sorry. So I will talk a little bit about the analysis of structural MRI in children. And here again, I get back to data that comes from Montreal Neurological Institute. They're involved in the NIH study of normal brain development, where they have scanned over 500 children with follow-up scans. And here you see average images. So they use a type of atlas building in different age groups. You see here 0 to 3 months, 3 to 6, 6 to 12, 18, 36 months. And if you play them as a movie, you can clearly see the challenges that we have for segmentation of such data. So you see here three parallel images. This is a T1, T2, and proton density contrast of the same child. And you see here the age axis. We just play first, and then I go back and tell you where you find the major difficulties. So after 24 months, an average brain, so this is an atlas, so this is averaged, looks more like an adult brain. Or even the contrast is even better than in an adult brain. If you go back, so I play first the 6 month, you see actually that the contrast in the images is inverse to what we expect in the adult, because white matter is not yet myelinated. It's not that myelinated at birth, or most of the white matter. And you see at the age of about 6 months, I go to 6, that the contrast completely disappears. So this is a little bit difficult due to the light, but here you see the T2 scan. There is no contrast between gray and white matter at that age. It just disappears. This has to do with the contrast mechanism of the MRI. It doesn't mean that the brain doesn't have white-gray matter, but you don't see it. So this is really a huge challenge. You also see the early myelination regions here. This is the internal capsule. You see these dark structures. They are already, to a high degree, myelinated. And if you follow the movie further, you see that these dark structures more and more extend. It's the anterior and posterior, and then you see it goes into the cortical regions. So if you have such data, you can just say every few weeks there is a huge change. Contrast, size, shape. I will show you later. It's not that hopeless. If you look at data of the same child, and I hope I... No, that's not the one. Okay, I will show you the slide later. This is just a radiology slide from UNC, Keith Smith. You see here again, 5 days, 6 months, and 14 months. And you see here again, with the contrast of T1, T2, that the contrast here is inverse. So white matter is darker than gray matter at birth, than at 2 years. And at the range, yeah, roughly at 6 months, you really see that the contrast between gray and white is nearly not visible. So for everyone who deals with segmentation algorithms that use statistical pattern recognition, this is really a huge challenge. You try to segment something that is not really visible in the data. So we have to find alternative solutions. This is the same baby again, just to show you where we are and where we have to find new solutions. This is the neonate stage, 1 year, 2 years. Here I calibrated all the data. So they're just within a fine transformation but into the same space. And here again you see the contrast inversion between neonate and 1 year and then 2 years. But what we can also see, if we zoom in, is that the boundary between gray and white matter, as you can see here, contrast still changes rapidly. So at 1 year of age, you don't have the full contrast that you expect if you look at the adult images. So it's more, I show you all these slides to tell you that a lot of methodology that we developed for adult-looking images or adolescents do not really work straightforwardly if you apply them to this age group. You have to rewrite your algorithms or find new concepts for segmentation. For the neonate, there is also an additional component that comes in. If you look at the neonate image, you see early myelination and not myelinated white matter. You actually have two categories. It's kind of a fraction of myelination that you can see in the data. And you see here in the algorithm that we developed at UNC, we have these two categories. The yellow are early myelination regions. You see here from the brainstem up to the motor cortex. And the rest of the white matter is not yet myelinated. So we separate both regions into two and do a segmentation of both. Okay, 6 and 4 month old, again, just to repeat again the message, there is nearly no contrast here. And the maximum that we can do here is to separate fluid from brain and just get the measure of brain size. But we do not yet promise that we could do any gray-white matter separation. Now, in the one-year-old, you see, if you look at the distance, it's like a scale. You feel you see something if you zoom in. There's really only little contrast between gray and white. And if you segment these images, this is now the same child. You see here the original T1 MRI at 1 year and at 2 years. And here we see the white matter segmentation. And here I show the probability map, so the segmentation probability for white matter using statistical pattern recognition. Now you can clearly see the difference between the two. And if you zoom in, you see that the 2 years, you start to see a sharp boundary between gray and white matter in the cortical region. But at 1 year of age, you have this fuzzy region. So it is like a conversion between, yeah, and not yet fully myelinated in the cortical regions. And this will surely be a huge challenge for any cortical thickness measurements. Probably you have to rethink about the mechanism of getting a sharp boundary, like step edges, and measure the distance to something which is more softish or fuzzy, maybe a fuzzy relationship between inside and outside. So we do not yet know. I just throw out these problems and ask you maybe to contribute to write algorithms to help us to approach these challenges. So we have, and also David Van Essen presented a few slides with segmentation algorithms. We created a new segmentation algorithm for the one-year-old, which uses, first of all, an age-specific prior. So you cannot just use an adult prior and map it to a one-year-old and hope you can use the same statistics for atlas-driven segmentation. We use a nonlinear registration of the atlas to the subject, a non-parametric clustering. So I don't want to go into details. This is all written up and published. But at least you get the partial success that you think we can segment the one-year-old and get probability maps for gray white tissue. The current solution that we have is that if we have data from longitudinal data from children, we provide individual segmentations. They always look bad if you do the binarization and color maps. They look much, much better if you look at the soft segmentations. But so far, our solution is to segment them individually and get measurements for volumes for gray-white CSF. We also parcelate the brain, as you find in many packages. But in principle, you can think about this is surely not the optimal technique, because if you would look at the individuals, if you align them, if you look at one baby that develops over time, maybe we should develop segmentation algorithms which take into account the whole process of development and not just take each individual and say, I don't know anything about the future images. So it should be probably a four-dimensional segmentation algorithm that takes into account the longitudinal axis. So we are not yet there, so we don't have that, but it might be something that we have to work on. So we have some early results. First of all, for example, gender differences at birth, which are already obvious in our database because we have more than 200 children that we already have for statistical analysis to see male-female differences in the whole brain or intracranial volume. Also the gray matter differences between the two genders. We also have early results on early brain growth. You see here the total volume, and that's obvious, neonate, 1 year old, 2, 4, adult. You see there's really a dramatic growth between neonate and 1 year old. And it's mostly, if you apply the segmentation algorithms, and if you believe that they do a good job in their probabilistic segmentation, you see growth is mostly attributed to gray matter, much more than to white matter volume. So this is just volume analysis. Doesn't tell you anything about what we actually mean by white matter. It's just volume differences across this age range. So I will come to the analysis of DTI in infants, because at the same time that we apply structural imaging, we also do DTI on every child using a high-speed sequence of about 5 minutes. And the huge challenge, and this goes back to what David Messen nicely laid out, it's the whole question of mapping. How do you map brains into a common coordinate system? So we use an atlas building technique inspired by Saran Joshi and presented at the last IPAM 4 years ago. And that was interesting for me to see. That's about the time frame. When you present something new, you publish it. I think that was Neuroimage 2004. and then actually make the program available so that it really runs. I mean, really runs means that a lot of people can use it on nowadays computers, and it runs on more than 10 data sets. So it took us now about 3 to 4 years to make the whole software ready to go for different type of applications. That doesn't mean it didn't work at that time, but to make it available to different projects and different people. So what we do is we have DTI images of a population and map it into an atlas. And this mapping is done by unbiased atlas building. So the atlas is created. It's not the choice of a template. And you can look it up in the NeuroImage paper if you're interested in the math. So there is a step in between. We actually convert the DTI images into structural images using a structural operator. So that's kind of a simplification. It's like in computer vision, you have an edge operator or a line operator, and then you use the structural features. Here we use the Hessian, the largest eigenvalue of the Hessian, as a measure of strongly structured white matter. And then we apply the standard procedure developed by Shoshi and his colleagues to get the deformation maps, the inverse of the deformation maps, and then the structural average. And here it's for DTI, it's obvious we are really happy about the inverse, about the diffeomorphic mapping, because we always go back and forth between the atlas and the images. And you will see also for the tensor averaging, where you need to rotate the tensors, we use the inverse of the deformation field. But this is a straightforward process. We have DTI images, we have the deformation fields, we do the averaging of the tensors and get the DTI atlases. And as I said, for local tensor field deformations, we use the local rotation of the Jacobian, as published by Alexander. And actually, we apply the fast version of the INRIA group of RCNI just to speed up the procedure. Okay, and this is just a result that we got recently. We have here a database of 150 neonate DTI images, and what I show is just the whole database and then the average atlas. So this is an average tensor atlas. And from the tensor, you can derive any type of features that you want, like FA, fractional anisotropy, mean diffusivity, eigenvalues, so whatever measures you use for your statistics. You see here, just side by side, this is probably not the slide that is most important for you, because you know it all, especially if you have been at IPAM before and believe in nonlinear registration. But linear registration is really not good enough, especially not for diffusion tensor imaging. Because if you look at the relatively small scale features that we have, we need a nonlinear mapping of the large variability of shapes that we have among the population databases. Okay, so far, and this is the work by Casey Goodlett, we have developed atlases for neonates, where we could use several hundred images of one-year-olds, of two-year-olds, and of adults. So this is not yet longitudinal. You see, we have age-specific atlases for the different groups. We built atlases for healthy subjects, and also we have built atlases where you have a mix between healthy and subject at risk. This is the mean diffusivity. So because we have tensor atlases, so we can just derive any scalar measurements from the tensors that you can use for your statistics. This is a movie of the FA from neonate, 1, 2 years, and adult. And most obvious is the change of fractional anisotropy in most of the regions, so in nearly all the tracks that you can see on this axial slide. This is just a very simple characteristic. If you would take the atlases and map them into one coordinate frame and fix two parts. So this is only a schematic to see what we actually go for. For example, we pick the genome and the splenium and map it from neonate, 1 year, 2 year in the adult. And this is just a very crude test. You see the mutificity is expected to go down with more structuring. And the fractional anisotropy here goes up. So this is somehow the expectation that we have for DTI, and everybody would say this is nothing new, we all know it, and this is what we want to measure. But you see the diffusion tensor imaging makes it a little bit easier. We don't have any contrast inversion at the age of 6 months. So we don't have to deal with this difficulty of missing gray white matter contrast, and that also leaves or creates maybe the idea we should combine both modalities if you do registration and population-based atlas building. So the next step is the data parameterization. So if you have a bundle here, part of the corona radiata, like the sensory motor cortex, we just parameterize with arc length. So we have a center region. We go left-right, so it's a very standard arc length parameterization of bundles, and we are surely not the only group that does this type of parameterization of bundles, and came up with a software package which is distributed as part of NAMIC, of the National Alliance for Medical Image Computing, where the PI is Ron Higgins. So this software is freely distributed as part of the NAMIC toolkit, where you do cartography, you can map, as you surely all know also from other packages, you can map colors like FA along tracts, and then especially you do tensor statistics. You parameterize the bundles by a spine, for example, you do statistics in cross sections along bundles, and then you can map them onto one-dimensional curves, and then you do statistics on these one-dimensional curves. So our contribution is less up to here, because we have a lot of choices for doing tractography, for mapping fiber tracts, but the contribution is more the next step to do statistics on fiber tracts and not on boxes. But you will see over this week there will be a lot of DTI talks on using different coordinate systems for mapping diffusion tensor data on skeletons, for example, or to boxes or other type of structures. So this is just an example, Anzinathus sepalus here, extracted from an atlas. Then we have the fractional anisotropy mapped as a color. You define a center of a coordinate system, and then we do the arc length parameterization. What we see here is the fractional anisotropy, the mean curve, as a function of arc length, and you can also see the standard deviation as a function of location. So it's more or less a very simple mapping of the properties of the diffusion data along a tract of interest. Now we can combine both, and again this is the PhD thesis work by Casey Goodlett. First of all, we can extract tracts from the atlases that we so far could not extract from individual data. So if you think about the fornix, uncinate, or other small tracts, the data from individual babies is by far too noisy. And if you have an atlas, of course, you have a smoothing process over a whole population. And that allows us to map tracts like the fornix, uncinate here, or cingulate, continent here again, successfully from the atlas. So the whole procedure is shown here as a layout. We start with the original images, create the atlas. We do the tractography in the atlas space. So this is our common space for tracts. We can map them back. You see, we use this diffeomorphic transformation that you can do the inverse. So you can map each track back into each original data set, get the original data from the diffusion tensor imaging data, and then get the sampled functions. These are the along-tracked diffusion tensor derived measurements, and then do functional statistics. You see, that's just the whole framework. There is a very strong assumption here. We really assume that the mapping here is valid. But I assume if you do brain mapping, that's not an assumption that is so uncommon. So you have to somehow, you can test it, you can validate it, but we have to know this is a strong assumption that we can successfully map each individual into this atlas, because we use the single track and map it back to collect all the data. So you see here two examples for these curves, all the fraction anisotropy curves, all the norm curves for now a 1 year and a 2 year. And here you see we combined both age groups. We used the 1 year group and the 2 year group. We mapped both into one atlas, and now we can do the statistics. So these are the individual curves for the diffusion data, just mapped into the common coordinate system. And now I have a question about time. Okay, I speed up. So I just throw in the buzzwords. We do functional data analysis on curves and not on points. So we use these functions here, which are continuous functions, and do a Bayes blind fitting to avoid original sampling of the voxels. So I go through very quickly, but this will be a paper presented at MIKAI. And get, we do functional PCA on this set of curves. It's a commonly known method that we applied to this DTI data, and reduce the number of parameters by clipping the number of PCA modes for the statistics. We do hypothesis testing and discrimination using Hotelling T2 statistics. So it's a very similar concept as you do in shape analysis, just apply to these continuous curves. And finally, again in this pediatric example, do discrimination. Okay, I quickly go through. And finally, as a result, what we get is actually the change along the discrimination direction. So you have the best discrimination direction between two groups. And that's again the same as you do in shape analysis. Here you see the FA and mean specificity. You see that if you go from 1 year to 2 years along this best discrimination axis, you see that most of the significant changes are increase in FA in the more center region of the genome tract. This is the same information for the motor tract. And if you map back all the original samples to the best discriminating axis, you see that we get an excellent separation. It's a little bit of a virtual example, because we know between 1 year and 2 years old there is surely a significant change, and nearly every method will produce data. But we just showed you that this is a concept of a type of a analysis software that we can now apply to also to babies at risk. Okay, and I come to the last slide. Sorry about that. So, conclusions. There is an amazing progress of imaging technology. So we could not do all this work without the new technology on 3 Tesla scanners and new pulse frequencies. There are newly developed image processing tools by many groups across the world. A wealth of new results. It's really a fascinating research area which is full of discoveries. Because there was not so much research done so far on the imaging of this age group. What we need is more multidisciplinary research. We have to learn much more about biology, anatomy, and especially about the underlying neurobiology. You look at the FA changes, mean diffusivity, but you really need to know what we measure and what it means. Or what is the contrast inversion? Why exactly the range? Why is the T2 and the T1 image not in sync? So we need a much, much better collaboration between neurobiology and the imaging findings. And this has been also mentioned by David Van Essen. There is increased sharing of data and analysis tools, and most of the data that I showed will become available for free, so it will be shared with the community. There are fundamental computational statistical problems, and I showed you everything changes, contrast, size, shape, appearance. So it's really no more easy to model. You cannot model a single image, you have to model the whole development across an age range. We need to do statistics of growth and images and structures, and here we have to go into longitudinal data analysis so that the time axis has to be taken into an account. And yeah, it's not only about statistics of images. We need to correlate or have the covariate of patient parameters. We often forget that in the early development, if you have children, especially if you have many children, you see their growth trajectory is not the same. There are gender differences, there are differences among different children, even if they have exactly the same age. You see that if you have to go to school. So there's really some questions here about the covariate. Is age really a good covariate, or should we use scores? So there's just a lot of open questions, but I hope I could show you that this is an area for research that is really worthwhile to contribute. Thank you very much.
Well, it's time for a couple of questions for Guido.
Guido, I have a question, which is, it relates to your wiring harness. Your wiring harnesses, right? When you generate all these linked lists, which are curves, and form your wiring harnesses. And for doing that, you essentially have to define the sub-volume in the image that corresponds to that tract.
Yeah.
Right. So, if instead of actually track tracing and ending up with 50 linked lists, which we call these curves, that form the wiring harness, I use that same anatomical information. You know, like the way Mori does it. I define in a white matter atlas a sub-volume that corresponds to that track.
Yeah.
And I bring it into the target, just, you know, diffeomorphism morphism program, all that. I never generate tracts, but I then do my statistics on FA rather than along all your curves that are your wiring harnesses, but just at the voxel level, but still the same subvolume corresponding to the wiring harness. Do I lose discrimination between the populations? What do I lose by doing that? You understand my question?
Yeah, I understand. I mean, after atlas building, you can do everything. You can do voxel-based statistics, you can do region of interest statistics by regions that you get from someone or someone draws it for you. And we have chosen the kind of route that we actually extract tracts. So the motivation why we use tracts, it's more because of the clinical applications, because clinicians, especially in psychiatry, neurology, their language is tracts. They talk about sensory motor cortex, and I think that was the main inspiration, that we liked to use tracts and do along track statistics rather than voxel-based statistics. But I would say you could do both. In voxel-based statistics, you usually create regions, you do significance analysis, t-tests, and then you map it into an atlas to get the name for this region. And this is probably the motivation. We wanted to avoid it and give the region first a name and analyze the data along this tract. And I see a lot of groups who want to do factual connectivity analysis. They would like to deal with this whole connector tracts and not just voxels. But I cannot tell you which method would be more powerful. I even see that they might be even combined, or maybe we do something similar. The analysis of tracts has an advantage because we can do a significant reduction of degrees of freedom. We do a smoothing, we do a B-spline, finally we do PCA, reduce the whole tract information on only 5 to 10 parameters. So it's a simplification of statistical analysis, which might not justify the method.
Thank you.
So I think in these two methods, in the ROI-based analysis, you do use increase the power to test the electron group difference. But in, in the ROI-based analysis, you lose the ability to look into the track shape. So we don't have that ability. For instance, in the newborns, the track is more flat. Then when it's 2 years old, the track becomes like a more curved, and then this gyroscope, you know, connection becomes open, you know, appears. Then we won't be able to see in the ROI-based analysis. So that's what I think ROI-based analysis is reduce our ability.
Yeah.
Right, but we didn't see, you know, when in this analysis, I'm sure it's there, we didn't see an LDA or something that had parameters associated with the shape of track.
No.
Not yet anyway.
We did not do that. So I know some groups work on that because it comes for free. You actually have the shape and the length and everything too. But we did not do any statistical analysis of that. I would compare it a little bit like hippocampus analysis by VBM, which is voxel-based, versus maybe segmenting the hippocampus by hand and get highly precise surfaces and do shape analysis, because one is more driven by an anatomical shape that you know, that you have in mind, and the other one is more based on discovery because you do not yet know where. Maybe you could even do both, and one is used for discovery and the other one is used for testing.
Christoph, you have a question.
One thing that troubles me though is that your analysis is restricted to the tracks that you can track in the average brain.
Yes.
But apparently, because this is a fairly fuzzy average brain, there are a few of them. At least few of them that you can see in the average brain. So, how do you feel about the fact that you might be losing a lot of other ROIs that you could otherwise find, but they're not visible in the atlas? Or
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, we only did the most obvious because everybody does corpus callosum, enantiomate, and cingulate because we all know them. I think, first of all, we can do much more tracts, especially in the high resolution atlas that we have. But I'm, as a not so well, whatever, educated neurobiologist, I even don't know all these tracts. And I'm not so sure about the second part. If you don't see the tracts, there will be a lot of variability. And if you do voxel-based analysis, you also have to assume, if you map them into a common atlas frame, that the mapping actually is valid. But the mapping is driven by a force, and the force comes through some structural operator that might go for maybe tensor shape or structural information. So. I so far, also going back to psychiatrists, they ask us the question about the most obvious tracts that they even have names and they can find in books. And so far, we did not go for some new discovery of maybe connections that are not yet known, and I would not know exactly how to approach this.
I have a question about the in the making of your DTI infant atlas, how do you deal with the problem of the fact that fraction is operating and all tensor-based metrics are also influenced by the myelination of the fiber fact? So as far as I know, it's not completely clear whether the fusion signal that we get is due to the restriction between axons or also inside, but definitely the myelination has an effect.
Yep.
So the point is that maybe in the atlas, you could find less fraction isotropy in some regions just because there is less myelination.
Yeah.
And
but that's
influence on the.
This is exactly the reason why we try to find a structural operator which is not yet invariant to the magnitude of FA, for example, but it's not directly related to FA. Because you can also use the FA image and do the atlas. But then you run into the problem of catch 22. Somehow you do statistics on the same measure that you use for atlas building. So we have some ideas also with the INVRIA group to replace the Hessian based on the FA images by some operators that are more independent of the diffusion properties. But this is well taken. Actually, interesting, I skipped these slides and we don't have time. Diffusion tensor imaging is not only driven by myelination. Actually, FA is more driven by structuring, and it's really amazing that the neonate, which is mostly non-myelinated, has such a very strong structuring in the DTI images. So the mean diffusivity is more sensitive to the myelination. But you're right, that's always the choice of the structural operators or the force field that drives the registration, and we have to be very careful about do we drive actually the registration by the value that we would like to statistically analyze or not.
Yeah.
It's a good point. Yeah.
All right, well, let's thank